Scott, we got a quorum. We don't need.
I was here earlier.
We don't need. You, but it would be worth sticking around for. Call the resources meeting to order. We always start on time, so it's 1 o'clock. Present Representative Edgman, Olson, Co-Chair Newman, Representative Seaton, Kawasaki, and myself, Johnson, and Representative Wilson, I know, is excused. Today, we're going to be hearing from the Armstrong Companies and the Ed Kerr. And to some of you, this will have great interest. To others, maybe less. But we're going to be talking about exploration for natural gas in the Cook Inlet. But Armstrong is a company that also has a great amount of experience all around Alaska. And without much further ado or stealing any thunder, Mr. Kerr, would you introduce yourself for the record and begin? And I'm sure you will pose. There will be a lot of questions that will come out of your initial brief. So with that, you have the floor, sir.
Thank you very much. Number one, let me thank you all for allowing me to come in here and speak to you. I know that gas in the Cook Inlet is a very large and important area of interest for everyone on the Kenai Peninsula, and it's been real dynamic in the last 5 to 10 years. And in large part, that's why I'm here, is to address that. But before I start there, let me tell you a little bit about Armstrong Oil and Gas. Armstrong Oil and Gas was formed 23 years ago. We are an independent company, and a true independent, which I recognize is something that the state of Alaska does not enjoy a lot of as far as independents up here participating. And I have some opinions as to the reasons for that, which we'll get into later. But we are an independent oil and gas company. We carry no debt. We do everything out of our hip pocket when we do things. We have been active in the state of Alaska, I will say, for about 10 years. Initially, we were on the north slope of Alaska. We went up there. I think we won our first leases up there in the year 2000. It's either 2000 or 2001. We drilled 11 wild. We have to date drilled 11 wildcats on the north slope. We had various degrees of success. Some of you may be familiar with the Uguric project that Pioneer has just placed online. That was an Armstrong project. The Nakayachuk project, the ENI is working on currently, was an Armstrong project. We ultimately had sold those projects to Pioneer and ENI just due to the fact that the capital expenditure associated with them and the pace that our partners wanted to go at was a little bit more than what we were ready to utilize in our capital expenditures, especially given the fact that we carry no debt. As I said, we've been around for 23 years. We're active in multiple states. We're active in Texas, the Gulf of Mexico, California, various Rocky Mountain basins, and Alaska as well. And in that vein, I think I am qualified to speak to, you know, the nuances in different states and different areas of operation with respect to what's good about certain areas, what's not as good about other areas. Every place has its strength, every place has its weakness, and I think that can come up somewhat today. As I mentioned, I'm really here for the Cook Inlet today. We had been on the North Slope, and with the advent of the changes in the tax laws in the Cook Inlet, it was a catalyst for us to look at making some capital investments within the Cook Inlet. And that in and of itself for us is a big step. We will really scrutinize areas prior to making capital investments because, as anyone else, we're in it to make a reasonable profit for our investment. But we did get in, and we acquired the North Fork unit after some clearing up some difficult legal situations that were around the North Fork unit, and this occurred in about 3 years ago that we acquired the North Fork unit. The North Fork unit was formed in the early 60s, and at the time we had acquired it, it had one well in it. So you had a situation where you had one well in this accumulation in a period of 40 years, basically. And I think that's a point that I'll go back to with respect to some of the challenges associated with the Cook Inlet gas market and the situation there. But we did acquire it, and we came back and drilled a well this past summer, and we were successful with the well that we drilled. The evolution of the Cook Inlet Basin is one that the wells that are being found today are not as good as those that have been found in the past. And I'll give you a few statistics. And I will say at this point, from my perspective, if you have any questions, feel free to interrupt me, because I think this is an open, for me, the best thing about it will be it being an open forum. My intention is to be able to get our thought processes across and what our goals are.
Mr. Kerr, I would encourage the committee, if you have it, to ask the questions, but at an opportune time to recognize that Representative Tuck has joined us and has been for quite some time. So if you'd proceed, but anytime there's a question, if you just get my attention, Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, you had mentioned that there was some difficulties with the North Fork issue. Were they government-related issues or just doing business issues?
You know, that's a great question. I'll give you a broad answer and then a very definitive answer. The broad answer is it's been our experience in dealing with the state of Alaska that the government overall is outstanding to work with. There are very specific challenges associated with doing business in Alaska, and on some very narrow instances there are challenges, but the people in the DNR, in the DOG, have been very amenable, and they try hard to work with us to work through those problems. With respect to the North Fork unit, it was really a function of the issues that our predecessors had created by virtue of what they had done while they owned the North Fork unit. Its history had been such that it was initially drilled by Unocal, and it was owned by very large oil companies for a long period of time, and they kept it a very tight package on it. Even though they did not develop it, they kept it in legal good standings. Sometime in the late 90s, it was bought by a series of very small individuals who parceled it out to even smaller individuals, and that's where the legal problems came from. And it was predominantly a function of lack of performance that the DNR could look at and say, we are moving forward, we are developing this asset. And it was also a function of some of the granting documents that they had done had issues with their drafting. So that was the predominant issues associated with the North Fork unit in that regard.
On that point.
Follow-up, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on that point, it really does me good to hear you say that you've got some good relationships with DNR, because I think Representative Johnson will agree that we hear from lots of people who maybe have not so good relationships at times. I'm concerned, too, about other regulations that are imposed on industry trying to develop. You know, the state spent literally billions of dollars to make sure that we have regulations based on good, sound science, you know, through the DNR, Habitat, land and mining. They do some great permitting. And I just want to, just very briefly, you know, is there other regulations that are imposed by communities and stuff like that make it difficult? Are you welcome with those communities? Do you work with them? I know that sometimes communities have the ability to impose their own regulations on industry.
Absolutely. I will say that at times we've had some challenges with communities, although for the most part we have been able to always work those out. I certainly recognize that there are, I have colleagues that have had more significant issues than we have with respect to that particular fact set. And I think that's something that may be better suited for them. And I will tell you, perhaps this is a good point maybe to segue. You know, as I sit here discussing with you the Cook Inlet, I have a couple goals. I want to relay to you what we feel like we've done in the North Fork unit. I want to relay to you what we think we might have found that's even more substantial there. And it's also our goal to make you aware that we are going to be moving forward in an attempt to get a gas contract with any utility that we can to move this gas to sell it to whatever communities is deemed best. It's going to have a price associated with it, and I'll get into that point. But those are my goals, and the alternatives from Armstrong's perspective are going to be as follows.
Before you go in there, are you still relative close to this
point? I think he's getting close to it, but originally Unocal was looking for oil on the North Float or
yes.
North Fork prospect.
Yes.
You're looking for gas right now?
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. Yes. No, you're exactly right. That was originally drilled, It's an old paleo structure that was originally drilled as an oil prospect into the hemlock. And in drilling through it, the Tionic, it became apparent, somewhat apparent, that there could be gas in the Tionic. And, of course, 40-some-odd years later, we drilled the subsequent well, the follow-up well to it, and have confirmed the gas in the Tionic. And there is still some potential for oil in the hemlock. And if we can work out the scenario with the gas, we can pursue that as well. So does that help?
Yeah.
With that?
Thanks.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Good.
Okay.
Please proceed. Thank you.
Absolutely. So those are our goals, is to let you know that we're going to move forward with an attempt to get a gas contract. The reason for being here, and after I leave here, I will be going on Wednesday to talk with the RCA. And looking at the historical precedent, I felt like it might be a good idea to let people know what we have done, what we are attempting to do, so that when we enter into a gas contract, that the RCA is aware of what we've done, and maybe short-circuit any miscommunication with them about gas contracts. Like any independent, we have a limited amount of manpower. And so to spend a tremendous amount of time negotiating a gas contract that is not going to be agreeable to them, we're better suited to pursue projects elsewhere and put our time into other projects. So those are my goals as I sit here.
Mr. Kerr, if you might, I would really like to avoid conversations about what may or may not be happening in front of a regulatory body in the very near future. I understand there's a contract. I don't want it to be perceived that if the legislature wants to fix something, we'll pass a law. And we won't try to influence. It is not our position to try to influence any type of regulatory agency. I think what we want to find out here is what the potential you're setting on, how we can be of assistance, not applying pressure. That's their job. If we feel we need to change something, we have ways of doing that. But I would like to avoid conversation about regulatory agencies, unless it's how they do stuff, what they do, and not deal specifically with your case, but maybe a broader picture, if that makes sense to everyone on the committee. Representative Seaton?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, of course, you know, this is my district.
Right.
And there have been some things that have gone through the RCA that were the contract, and which is maybe interfering with my community's being able to get gas. In other words, there's a great fear in my community that the folks that have the certificate of public necessity and convenience for Homer, the way they structured it, they rolled it into the entire rail belt structure that NSTAR services. And so, and everybody was unaware of this, and so the concern is that this gas is then going to be exported from the local area, either once it's in that system, it either goes to Tokyo or goes to Anchorage or other places without building the infrastructure that was required under the RCA contract. So at some point in time, not getting into future RCA questions, but there is a real question of local supply of gas and whether that's going to be assured or prevented by the actions that have taken place before the RCA. So I'm not trying to get in and influence RCA decision, but I think the committee needs to be aware of some of the existing contracts and competition that it preceded at the RCA, so we know whether we are doing something that we've all said we want to do and have local supplies of gas for Alaskans, or whether we are actually in a position through those contracts of exporting gas from the local areas. So in that aspect, I'd like to be able to discuss
that. Representative Seaton, I think in the broader conversation that you're talking about, that's fine. What I want to avoid is a specific docket that might be before the RCA in light of some of the things. But I will tell you that the co-chair and I have discussed possibly having RCA come before us to explain some of the things, just exactly what you've talked about, how they make the process. So I think you can see that in a future hearing. So don't think you've got to do it all today. From the Armstrong perspective, gather the information you need, and you'll have another shot at those guys at the RCA. we will try to get them before us.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. But I would like to explore with Armstrong their intention to service local market, and they've expressed that they're looking for contracts with communities.
Right.
And I want to know whether communities can contract with them for gas or whether they're tied up with and prevented from doing that by the RCA certificate.
I certainly think that's a fair question and doesn't cross into that area that I was hoping to avoid with the specific questions about the upcoming hearing.
Thanks, sir.
And let the record show that Representative Guttenberg has shown up as well. Thank you. Any other questions while we're here? Got a little break? Sure, if you'd proceed, thank you.
Yes, and duly noted. So our goal as Armstrong is to enter into a gas contract and move forward. We did find gas at the North Fork unit. We have been successful. Now we have two wells in this accumulation. The unique thing about exploration and development of assets of oil and gas is that until you expand yourself and drill additional wells, you really don't know what the limit is of how big or small your asset can be. At this point in time, we're very comfortable that we have an asset that is in that 7.5 to 12.5 billion cubic feet of gas. I do not think it's unrealistic. Said another way, I think it is realistic that we very well may have something that is in the order of 20 to 60 BCF of gas, and there is some potential that it could be substantially larger than that. The issue associated with those numbers that I've just quoted is, those are all risk numbers. We will not be able to know until we drill additional wells. And so as we sit here today, we've made a substantial investment in this asset, in the acquisition of it, and the drilling of the first well. We're going to move forward with an attempt to get a gas contract, and then we'll move forward beyond that with the development of the asset and the drilling of additional wells. With respect to the capital expenditure associated with what we're doing, again, I think we have a very broad bandwidth on how much we'll be spending, but it could be anywhere from 40 to substantially $40 million to substantially more than that. Again, dependent upon the subsequent well results as we move ahead. We know we have an asset. We know it has gas. We know that it can flow substantial amounts of gas. But entrenched in that, the fact that we're spending that.
Before you go forward, I think we have a question. But before, I want to clarify something. You said that once you get a contract, you will then go out and prove up more reserves. Is that typical? Or is it typical that you, that, and maybe that's a function of you being a cash company as opposed to a, you know, a larger, you know, an independent, that may be a function of your business model. But is it typical to get the contract and then go prove the reserves a little more and sell more? So help walk me through. Typically, it seems like you'd prove the reserves and then go out and try to sell them as opposed to selling them and then going and finding them. Am I misreading that a little bit? Or?
It's a great question. And I think what I would say is we're about in between because we've proven the reserves. You know, we know the reserves are there. We have two wells that have done that. And so in that vein, I would say that we have already drilled the wells and we have proven our reserves. Now all we're going to define is how big those reserves are. You know, are they going to be of this magnitude or are they going to be substantially larger than that? And I think I know that that is the norm. It is a unique situation in the Cook Inlet that is much different than what you see conventionally in the lower 48 where we do a lot of different things. And the unique nature of it is that you have limited gas buyers, whereas in the lower 48 you have just a whole bunch of people that are always anxious to buy your gas. Also, for the most part, in those areas that have production, you've got a whole lot of gas pipelines that are already there and in place. In the Cook Inlet, that's not the case. You know, you have some areas where you don't have a gas pipeline in place, and you have a limited number of folks that are able to buy the gas. We certainly have recognized the challenge that is in front of everyone that is a producer in the Kenai Peninsula in the sense that we see that almost every single field, with a couple of exceptions that are producing, were found in the 60s and 70s in the Kenai Peninsula, or in the Cook Inlet. And those fields have been tremendous, world-class gas fields and oil fields. They were initially drilled as oil wells, and they found associated gas. And they've been world-class production. But they're declining at this point in time. And so it frankly places the Kenai Peninsula in a gas market that I've never seen before. When you have a significant decline associated with 96% of your production, and a limited amount of wells that are being followed up and being drilled out there. I will tell you before I came up here that I pulled a couple of different things, and I found a couple of basins that are similar in size to what the Cook Inlet is. And one of them was the Bighorn Basin, and one of them was the San Juan Basin. And each one of these are about 100 miles by 100 miles. And these three basins are very similar. The San Juan Basin is quite a bit more prolific, but the Bighorn and the Cook Inlet are fairly comparable basins as far as how much oil and gas they've produced. Just to give you the numbers, the cumes to date for the Cook Inlet are 7.6 TCF and 1.3 billion barrels of oil. The Bighorn Basin is 2.4 TCF and 3.1 billion barrels of oil. And the San Juan Basin is a bit larger. It's 41.5 TCF and 380 million barrels of oil. But I pulled these basins just to demonstrate to myself, more than anything else, what the challenges can be in the Cook Inlet. Are these challenges real, or am I imagining them? So we have three basins of similar size. And in 2007, the San Juan Basin had 984 wells drilled in it. That's understandable. It's a prolific basin. And
can you tell us where are those? I mean, I think San Juan's, I'm thinking off the coast of Washington. So
actually,
where?
It's New Mexico, northwest New Mexico, and the Bighorn is in northwest Wyoming. So that's the location of both of these basins.
Before you go on, Representative Newman, you had a question?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is going to fit right into the discussion that you're at right now. If you could kind of tell me how many jobs are involved in all this as we go along with this. But I think the root of my question or my concern is, Mr. Chairman, is, and I've been trying to figure this out in my mind, we're looking at building sanctioning a 24-inch pipeline from Prudhoe Bay down to South Central, Governor's in-state gas pipeline. And we'll be looking at that pretty hard in this committee. And my concern is, as soon as they turn the valves on that pipeline, Cook Inlet exploration is going to come to a screeching halt, and people are going to be losing jobs. You've talked about investments of over $40 million, some of these fields into some what you feel have the potential to be some real world-class oil and gas fields. I know that there's going to be a tariff associated with transport from down there, so maybe you can beat the price of Cook Inlet or North Slope gas. But boy, it just scares me, you know, if they've got Prudhoe Bay connected into South Central, what is going to happen to all those jobs? And when I look at my friend to the left here, who represents that area, I know that they've had some devastating economic times down there with the closing of Agrium. And the loss of all that many more jobs and investment into their communities. I'm very concerned about that. What do you think is going to happen to South Central if a 24-inch pipeline from the North Slope comes down?
And maybe you can tag the answer to my question on is, what's your timing? The bullet's got a time. What's your time frame in deliverability? And if they both go on the market at the same time, I see a real problem.
Yeah.
So you might address jobs as well as timing for what you're looking at.
Both of those are great questions. I can tell you what I'll give you is my opinion. And my opinion is based on 25, 26 years in the business. But my opinion would be that, first of all, if they were going in the same time, I think your assertion could be accurate. It could be very, very difficult for the Kenai area as far as people potentially losing jobs. I will say that our timing will be such that we will be on well before any bullet line gets built and approved. And I am no expert by any means on the bullet line and the manifestations that go along with that. But I do know for a project of that size and scope, it's formidable, and there will be a lot of challenges. Our intention would be to sell gas as soon as a pipeline is built. And, you know, feasibly, that might be late 2010.
And when you say pipeline, you're not talking about the bullet line, you're talking about?
Correct.
A pipeline from the field to existing infrastructure?
That is correct.
Okay, so I just, when we start talking pipeline, we've got so many pipelines going on that we want to make sure we're not, all of a sudden we walk out of here thinking we're going to have a bullet line in a year. Representative Olson.
I think you're talking, what, 15, 20 miles?
Yes, sir. It's dependent upon the route, you know, there's various manifestations of it, but I would say closer to 20.
Distinct advantage.
Right. I would say 20. But we could, you know, we have wells that are ready to produce today is our point. Now, we need to be prudent and we need to follow appropriate permitting guidelines, which we always do and would. But with that, as soon as those are done, those wells are ready to produce. And frankly, in the interim, we could drill additional wells and have those ready to produce as well.
And along those lines, does this gas need to be processed or is it clean gas ready to go? Is this like most cook inlet?
It's traditional cook inlet gas. It's from the same formations. It's got the same source. So, you know,
so there's no processing plant involved?
No. Okay. There's no inert gases there, so it should be fine.
Thank you. Representative Olson, was that?
No, I have one follow-up. You also have a ready market for the oil in the event that you...
Yes.
Tesoro, I believe, is only using 25% cook inlet oil at this point in time and would...
Exactly.
Gladly, probably pay a premium. Are we allowed to say that word?
you can say anything you want.
Have plain oil.
They're not here.
Exactly. No, I think you're right. And of course, with oil, it's not as a formidable problem because oil you can transport in trucks safely. And I know there's some that are advocates of compressed natural gas on roads. Armstrong is, as yet, is not at that point. And we think a pipeline is the best way to go for natural gas in that regard.
Any other questions while we're here? Go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. So with respect to that, just to recap, we have these three basins that are comparable in size. And we go to 2007. The San Juan Basin had 984 wells drilled in it. The Bighorn Basin had 100 wells drilled in it. And the Cook Inlet, relatively comparable in its magnitude of production, only had, I pulled from two different data sources. In one, they called it 8 wells, and the other, they called it 14, and that's just a function of them being staked versus completed. But the point I want to make with that is literally 10% as many wells drilled in the Cook Inlet that there are in the Bighorn Basin, and 1% of what is drilled in the San Juan Basin. I'll take that a step further and look at the total number of wells that have been completed in those basins. And when you look at the San Juan, it's 44,700 and change. In the Bighorn, it's 12,800 and change. And in the Cook Inlet, it's 1,312. Again, you see this disparate difference in percentages of wells that have been drilled.
Mr. Kirk, could you put in writing or where show us where you got that? The
Absolutely.
Number of wells and submit that
Absolutely.
To staff so that we can put that in the record.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Yes, I can do that. And while that's a signal that not a lot has been done in the Cook Inlet, I think it is also a signal that a lot could be done in the Cook Inlet in the future. Today, I would say, in my opinion, that the bulk of the production that is out there has come from traditional structures that were drilled in the 60s and early 70s in the Cook Inlet. Today, when you go into the lower 48, there's a lot more exotic type of production that is occurring. And you see that in the gas price. It's in the lower 48 with all the shale gas plays that are going on from the Montney Shale in Canada to the Marcellus in the Northeast to the Haynesville down in Louisiana to the Barnett in Texas. These shale gas plays have really served a purpose for the lower 48 in helping drop the price of gas. And I think it served that purpose in two forms. One, it found a tremendous amount of gas. And number two, it created competition between the service companies. And it made those services, the cost of services, drop. And the fact of the matter is, we sit here today, I can tell you that the cost for us to drill a well in the Cook Inlet versus, say, other areas that we may do something in, call it the Permian Basin or the Barnett Shale in Texas, can be as much as 400 to 600% more. And it's a real challenge as an independent oil and gas company to have those exorbitant costs. It necessitates that you sell your product at a given price, otherwise you're going to lose money. And with the Cook Inlet where it is today, the big, large, easy reserves have been found. I do believe, in my opinion, there is a lot of gas yet to find in the Cook Inlet, but it's not going to be as easy as it has been in the past. I think it's going to be more challenging. I think the best way that one can find that gas is to create an environment where independents can come up here and feel like they're going to get a reasonable return on their investment. And I guess that's circling back to these numbers that I've just stated. When you look at the number of wells drilled in 2007 and the cumulative number of wells that are out there for these respective basins, I think what you're seeing is that to date, for whatever reason, independents have felt like that it is going to be a real challenge to get a return on their investment in the Cook Inlet by drilling wells. And I think it's manifested itself with not a lot of wells being drilled. For a basin this size, that is an extraordinarily small number of wells to have been drilled. And so that's just a general comment about the Cook Inlet in general. I do think from a tax structure standpoint that the legislature has done a wonderful job in the Cook Inlet of recognizing that you need to do something to encourage people to get out there and drill. And certainly I think you've hit the mark there, and I don't know that there is a lot of other things that can be done in that regard other than just see if there's a way to, well, I maybe said a better way is we just need to move forward and make certain that we can get a return on our investment. And that's what we're in the process of doing. I think when we look at Armstrong, we have a whole series of what will happen with us with respect to the Cook Inlet next. If we can go out there and come to an arrangement, we'll move forward with drilling additional wells, and it may be some and it may be a lot. The future results will dictate that. If we cannot come to an arrangement that we feel like gives us a reasonable shot at a return, then we'll just have to mothball it until some point in time that we feel like we can.
Representative Newman, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, you had mentioned that, you know, what all can the state do, and you provided a good tax structure for you to invest in and to sell your products. And what is Armstrong doing to, are you talking to other companies about any other types of opportunities to produce our gas and added value? You know, I'm very interested, you know, along with my co-chair, and what opportunities can we do to create more jobs for Alaskans, GTLs. I know that we don't have a lot of natural gas liquids, you know, very dry gas cooking it, but the opportunity to get those GTLs, and it kind of, you know, I think then we would certainly have the opportunity for plenty of gas to be able to be used for a customer base with a bullet line and all the exploration that you're doing. If we could have some more added value marketing there. Who are you talking to about other opportunities for using our gas and converting it to other added value products?
Absolutely. Great question. I think as it pertains to the Cook Inlet as opposed to the North Slope, you know, we office, our primary office is in Denver, but we're in Houston, we're in Dallas, we're in all parts of the world all the time talking to other companies, and we do take on partners in many of our projects. We continue to talk to people. I will say this maybe as a general statement. I think the pervasive nature of the Cook Inlet is such that there's a skepticism of for an independent to go in there and be able to work a contractual arrangement in order to sell their gas at a price that will allow them to get some type of reasonable return. I would say that there will probably be a lot of people that will be in the independent community that will be watching to see what happens with that. I might use an analog. When we went up to the North Slope initially, when we first got there, you know, there's always skepticism when you're breaking new ground. And when we got up to the North Slope, the theory was that an independent cannot do business on the North Slope and you'll never get anything done. And as we sit here today, the Gurick Island is online and producing. Nikaichuk wells are being drilled at it, and I think the capital expenditure associated with those two projects that has been committed is a little over $2 billion. And you would be surprised in the oil and gas community how much of it is observation of companies to see what the first guy, you know, how he fares out there. So in that regard, I would say that there's a lot of folks that are looking and watching, and we'll have to wait and see where that goes, whether how many would follow or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it fair to ask, and maybe we're stretching out there too far, and that's fine, but when you, I mean, obviously with any business plan, you have to develop, you know, your price and your price range and stuff. Do you have any idea that you could share with us what you think you can sell your gas for and cook in? What are your market prices or what range it can be in?
Yeah, it's a great question.
You might not want to answer it, though.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter
it's
is...
fine, but it's very important what we're doing today.
Exactly. I don't know. I can tell you what I think we need.
Cost of production. What's your cost of production?
You know, I think when it's all said and done, we're going to need to be in that, you know, $7 to $10 range, and we haven't firmed that up in absolute terms. But the challenge is, and I apologize, I wish we were better suited to find gas at a cheaper price. But the challenge that we have is the wells that we're drilling, we found gas and we know it's there, and we can produce that gas. And I think there could be a substantive amount, a large amount of gas associated with it. But there is simply a cost, you know, and when we're talking about potentially spending 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, whatever amount, millions of dollars to do this, you know, we will, if we don't get a price that will allow us to potentially get a reasonable return, we'll go out of business. And, you know, the unfortunate reality is I've got colleagues that in Dallas and Houston and in Denver that are going out of business because they haven't minded their business. And from the perspective of Alaskans, I hope that you'll appreciate for us to come in here and say, you know, we can do this for $5 in MMBTU. If I don't do it, I've done you no good. If I just say I'm going to do something and I don't actually do it, then it just does nothing for you.
Representative Newman?
Quick follow-up. And that's an interesting question. That's 7 to 10 a million BTU. Because when I'm trying to formulate in my mind, it's cost of production and tariff on a deliverable gas from the North Slope or Gubik or wherever the case may be. You know, in my little brain here, I'm trying to come up with maybe 15, 17 upwards of there, and if you're in at 7 to 10, you're very, I mean, gosh, just look at that. You know, I'm sure the industries, you know, are, when you're trying to get an FT with the utility companies and bring all that together, that's a pretty good information that you just kind of let out there.
Yeah, and that's, and you know, again, the challenge we have is I don't have absolutes. I know directionally this. I know we have gas. I know we can produce gas for you. I know it's there. We've already tested it and produced it. What I don't know is, you know, how significant the reserves will be. I also don't know exactly what my cost structure will be on the other side. Inevitably, in the exploration and development business, you have issues. You have problems drilling. A pipe gets stuck in the hole. You lose things in the hole. All of those things create cost overruns. And unfortunately, I can point to wells that we have been involved in where we went in thinking, you know, this well will be X dollars. And when we're done, we find out that well was 2X. It was twice as much as we thought it was. So there, those are the challenges from our side that make it where we're going to have a price that allows us to stay in business. Otherwise, not only have we not done ourselves any good, but we haven't done you any good as well.
Mr. Chair, I hope that they can come to Alaska and make a good profit, along with other companies that want to come here and make a profit, or else they will not be here. They will be somewhere else. So,
Representative,
nothing wrong with that.
No.
Thank you. And first, before I get into my question, I was wondering if we could follow up. Do you know what the current sales price is under current contracts, approximately, in Cook Inlet?
In Cook Inlet, you know, I'm probably not the best person, but I do think it's. I know that there are some that are over $8, and I think there are some that are under $8. But to be
somewhere in that range.
So. Yes, okay. That's correct.
Thank you,
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess a couple of questions. We're talking about supply and going into a pipeline, and I was curious on your take on the Ketchmack, the Kenai Ketchmack pipeline, which is the. Is that an 8-inch line?
The KKPL?
Yeah.
That's a 12-inch line.
The 12-inch pipeline. And my understanding is that that pipeline is under a settlement or under a contract, so that 95% of its capacity is taken up by the existing gas suppliers through 2014, leaving only like 5% available for additional suppliers into that pipeline. Do you know if that's the case and how, and I'm sure you've looked at Alaska law and all, with an intrastate pipeline and a common carrier situation where you would be able to put more gas than that into the line and there would be, you know, reductions and others for what were nominated. Can you just talk to us about the common carrier intrastate pipeline and the idea that here's a pipeline, a regulated pipeline that's not regulated as a common carrier for your access, but is a contract that basically excludes you?
And Mr. Kerr, if you're not, I mean, I understand you're an explorer and and a gas producer, not a pipeline company. So you know, if you're not comfortable, but certainly the information is something we're going to want to know at some point.
I can give you a very broad answer because I'm by no means an expert in it. I will tell you this, that our preliminary investigation has led us to the point that that pipeline is not at capacity. In other words, there is plenty of space to flow additional gas through it. As far as specifically who owns that capacity, I could not answer that question for you specifically. I'll tell you, historically, when you have spare capacity, usually you have folks that are anxious for you to utilize that capacity because otherwise they're just spending money to do nothing with it. So I would like to think that we could work through that issue, but I cannot answer your question specifically at this point.
Representative Seaton.
And, Mr. Chairman, the reason I bring it up is because, you know, there is some legislation talking about changing the Pipeline Act that we have in Alaska because currently pipelines are supposed to be common carriers, but we're not acting as common carriers. We're allowing contracts and settlements to make them as basically closed carriers, and my understanding is that pipeline has 95% of its capacity tied up by contract with only retaining 5% open. So somebody might be very willing to sell some capacity, but it's not quite the same, and we'll be looking at that later. So that's why I wanted to bring that up. But on the pipeline, I guess what I'm curious is at 7.5 to 12 BCF proven reserves, and you'd be ready to ship now. What size line and what MCF per day would you be looking at? Not the potential in the future, but if you were contracting with somebody now, what would you be comfortable supplying into a pipeline?
That's a great question. Let me answer this in a couple of different ways. One, the only thing from allowing us to provide more gas than we have today is just the fact that we have not spent the money to drill additional wells. At this point, we're comfortable that we can drill more wells and get more gas. I guess I want to make certain that I don't mislead you. You know, when you say proven reserves for public companies, and we're not a public company, sometimes the connotation associated with that is that you've had an engineering report done on these reserves. Since we carry no debt and we're not a public company, we do everything out of our hip pocket, we're not saddled with that. So, you know, these reserves are, I guess, in that context, we're comfortable enough with these reserves that we've spent a lot of money to date, and we're willing to spend additional money in order to go out and acquire the additional reserves that are out there. As far as what we could send, I guess, you know, realistically, we're looking at least a year to get a pipeline in. During that time, we could drill a couple of more wells easily, probably. And I think, you know, the capacity for us to do 6 to 7 million cubic feet a day consistently is very obtainable. And if we drilled additional wells, it could be substantially more than that.
And we're really not oil and gas industry folks. Most of us aren't here. Some have worked on pipelines before. I'm trying to figure out on a 6 to 10 MCF, what size pipeline would that be going required to service that need? I mean, is that a 6-inch line? Is that an 8-inch line?
It's, well, you know, I think it could be any of those with compression, but I think you could do it with a 6-inch line. Just fine, and if you know, possibly size it larger if you wanted.
Representative,
and I'd like to follow up because the, you know, backing up historically a little bit on this field, Homer Electric Association, which is a utility cooperative, and Homer and, well, the whole peninsula, and NSTAR competed before the RCA 8-10 years ago when this unit was there to see who would have the service supply for Homer and Anchor Point in that area. And NSTAR won that, and part of that contract obligation was a requirement that the North Star, who was the owner at the time, build an 8-mile pipeline to Anchor Point. And then NSTAR picked it up from Anchor Point and was obligated under that contract to build the distribution lines and transmission into Homer and all. And it's always been a little bit of a concern to me that there's a contract that requires a, you know, somebody that's in the drilling business or oil and gas industry, and I wasn't sure whether you were set up to or whether you do build, you know, that 8-mile pipeline from the North Fork Field unit to Anchor Point. Is that something that you would be prepared to do as part of a contract thing, or is that just out of your realm of operation?
It's a great question. I think to the extent that we had come to an arrangement that everyone was agreeable to, we certainly could accommodate building pipe to Anchor Point. That would not be a problem for us.
Oh, okay, great. I wasn't sure how that worked with a regulated pipeline and an independent company and whether those two things went together. So I appreciate that. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the last.
Yeah, and that's quite right now, but I think that's also something, and hopefully we get into some regulations that they may or may not allow you to build that pipeline.
Right.
You know, so
whole nother story.
Yeah. As to who can.
Sure.
Any Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Recently, I watched a presentation on horizontal drilling and directional drilling, and a lot of it's actually happening in the Rocky Mountains.
Yes.
Is your company thinking about applying these technologies without requiring more wells to be able to tap in more of those resources on the existing two wells you have now or any futures?
Fantastic question. I think if I can bore you for a second, I'll talk about what we call the depositional geology, and what I want to talk about are two different formations. The gas that we're looking at is in the Tionic Formation, and we refer to these as lenticular sands, and that means nothing more than what we see is that there's an abundance of these sands, but they're coming and going. It's not one big continuous sand, and so if you imagine, you know, just your fingers in there. And with respect to that, I think we're going to have to, as we drill additional wells, we'll define what what is the best way to drill it. We will start out with conventional vertical wells. The concern is when you have these types of lenticular sands, if you get into a given sand and you turn and go horizontal in it, you may leave it relatively quickly, and it defeats the purpose of your horizontal wellbore to open it up, open up as much of the reservoir as you can. Conversely, underneath it, the deeper formation that has produced most of the oil in the Cook Inlet is a hemlock formation, and this is what was originally drilled for way back in 65 by Unocal. And with the technology that is out there in the form of horizontal drilling, it may in fact be that the hemlock could be commercial. We don't know that at this point in time, and it's extremely expensive to drill a well to find out. We'll not be able to do that unless we underpin it with gas production. But I think the application of horizontal drilling technology in the deeper hemlock formation could absolutely be something that that we could utilize. And thank you for that point, because I think it's a great point in the context when we talk about the Cook Inlet, that there's two things that I think could dramatically change the production profile of the Cook Inlet. One is horizontal drilling, and the other is frack technology. And again, I'll revert back to the fact that there has been so few of wells drilled in the Cook Inlet at this point in time that the service companies have not put their manpower towards getting the frack technology, the horizontal drilling technology that you see in the lower 48 is not being applied as predominantly in the Cook Inlet as it is in the lower 48. Now, you do have certain instances, obviously the directional drilling at Cosmopolitan that Pioneer has done is very sophisticated, and they've done an excellent job with that. I think those guys are very bright. But I do think the number of wells that are being drilled, and again, I think it harkens back to just the economic threshold for applying that type of technology and the costs associated with it has made it, to date, for whatever reason, no one has wanted to pursue it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and Representative Tucker. I think this, if characterized, this would be more if to characterize as a traditional gas plug, as opposed to the shale or something else that's a little outside. This is the more find a pocket of gas, and
yes,
it's a little different than some of the stuff. And I know what you're talking about, but it's a little different. Mm-hmm. You know, it more traditional. There's a big, for lack of a better term, bubble of gas down there, and you drill into it, and it comes up, opposed to something where you got to go and break it up and have it flow into.
So that's exactly right. But the unique thing, I'll just say this as a play saver for you, because you're exactly right. But the unique aspect is, I don't know that enough drilling has occurred in the Cook Inlet to define and say that there is not, we refer to them as unconventional right. gas plays, right. to say that there's not some unconventional gas plays that are out there, that with the utilization of horizontal drilling could be exploited. And that's one of the, that's just another area that could be explored.
Yeah, thank you, Reverend Tucker. Reverend Newman?
Mr. Chair, could you maybe ask, could we ask the DNR folks to come in and—
Now?
just a future meeting and talk to us about gas formations and what's in Cook Inlet, who's working where. I think that'd be very interesting to this community to find out. We've heard about some of the quantities of gas and where they may be located from Mr. Kerr. Good information, but I'd like to hear from the department.
We can certainly do that.
Yeah, and Mr. Kerr, if I could follow up on a question I asked earlier, and how many companies do you think are working in Cook Inlet, and how many people are employed out there right now? I know how many people you've got employed, but as a good business person, you probably know what your competition's doing pretty closely too.
Right. Let me give you my best efforts to answer that question. I think obviously you have the large companies, Marathon, ConocoPhillips, Chevron, Texaco, and I don't want to guess as to how many people they employ. Beyond that, obviously there's ourselves, and if you look in the recent past, I know Pelican Hill was out there for a period of time, and they have since left doing anything in the Cook Inlet, and I think they just found some of the challenges too significant for them to overcome. I'm guessing at that. I have no direct knowledge, but the fact that they're not there would lead me to believe that. I know Aurora Gas is there, and I'm not certain to what extent they're actively exploring at this point in time. So really, I think the big three have had, I don't want to say a monopoly because they've been doing their business, but they've certainly been in the Cook Inlet for a long period of time, and I think that's been a challenge for the Cook Inlet. And you see it when you look at the number of wells that have been drilled relative to other basins. I can tell you, in the lower 48, the people that drill the wells are the independents. Independents are the ones that drive the engine. We're little guys. We're not as well-heeled as the majors, but we do have a good work ethic, and we pursue things rigorously, and we get wells drilled. And I think the Cook Inlet suffers from not having independents like Armstrong, like Aurora, and others that are up here that have a viable economic environment in which to sell gas. I think there could be. I think a lot of people will look and see what happens with Armstrong. I think people have looked in the past and looked at Pelican Hill and a little bit at Aurora and say, you know, maybe there's some challenges there and I want to look a little further. But I think that that's a significant piece of the puzzle for the Cook Inlet is to have independents there drilling wells.
I guess
Representative Newman,
follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question again was, like, how many jobs are involved in the Cook Inlet area? And I know maybe you don't want to answer for other companies, but companies that you work with, you know, it's not just your company, but you contract out, you sub to a lot of different types of companies.
Absolutely.
How many people does Armstrong work with, Armstrong Oil and Gas, are you working with in Cook Inlet? How many jobs would be affected if you left the state?
Well, I can tell you with this last well that we drilled, we probably employed, you know, in various capacities, don't hold me exactly to the number, but, you know, at least around 100, if not 200, you know, from people building location to mud men to mud engineers to drilling contractors to hands on the rigs to surveyors to road builders to fence builders. I would put it between 100 and 200 for that well by itself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, and I fully agree that, you know, we need independence, but I just wanted to bring a little other context into that. The North Fork Field was owned by North Star, who failed to follow their production agreements, was bought out by, I believe it was GasPro, who failed to go forward. You know, the unit was right at the point of being deunitized and being taken back. Armstrong was trying to acquire it, and the deadline was there. And, you know, there were talks, can this go forward? DNR worked with them, said, you know, this is, you know, because we were in talks with them trying to figure out how we were going to get this unit, because we're looking at getting gas for Homer. And they said, these guys have a tradition of following through on their work product, the work product that they said they'd do. And they gave an extension for getting a drill rig down there so that the road limits could be off. They produced the well, they did the job. So, you know, independents, I believe, are vitally important, but we shouldn't classify all independents just because they're an independent as somebody that's going to be the person that's coming in and completing the job. And so I think that, you know, I mean, I've been extremely pleased with what Armstrong has done. They followed through on every work commitment they've made that I'm aware of, and I think we need to, you know, aid those companies, but we also have to worry about North Star could have been developed years ago, except that we had some people that tied up the unit, didn't have the resources to develop it, and it went right to the point of expiration of the unit going away. So I think that we, you know, it's vital that we work with independents, but that we have strong work commitments and time limits. Otherwise, we get into the point of not having the unit developed, which was like I say, right on the verge of expiration when they were able to get it. So I really appreciate what they've done, and thanks to them for that.
And Representative Seaton, I agree with you, and I think, you know, it's always good to have better partners than lesser partners in the state. I look at these independents as partners, and the majors as well. They're partners with the state. What I would like to see is that the state is a good partner too, and that we're not doing things that hold the process up. And so that's kind of the purpose of kind of my goal, to make sure we make it as easily for them to do it right as we possibly can, and we become a helpmate, not an obstacle. So I don't disagree, and we've had some bad partners. But you'll find some partners that have said they've had some bad partners in the state too, so.
No disagreement there. But I just wanted to draw back and make sure that we realize that we need independents that are going to follow through on work commitments. And if we don't follow through on work commitments, then what we're doing is we're tying up our resources.
Right. We need good partners. Representative yep. Olson.
Well, it's probably worth repeating, but up until about the last 10 years, virtually all the gas that was found in Cook Inlet was by geologists that were looking for oil. That's why we still have gas here. It has not had the priority that oil has had over the years, and I think that's why companies like Armstrong are back in looking. Same with Marathon. Marathon's been looking for the last 8 or 10 years, but they fired most of the geologists, I believe, that
I think you're right.
Found gas more than twice.
Fired. Yeah. Heck of a incentive, huh?
Yeah. Additional questions while we're here? Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think your point was great, Representative Seaton. You know, independent has a very broad umbrella that people fall underneath, and in that you've got folks that do what they say they're going to do, and you've got other folks that candidly sometimes are just looking at getting in the way of somebody who's trying to do something, and to pay attention to that, I think, is extremely important. It's just as you said, Representative Johnson, we have partners as well, you know, both oil company partners as well as state agencies that we work with, and we scrutinize that also. We try to make certain that when we have a partner, that it's going to be somebody that you can do business with, that is going to be there for you. And that's why, as I'm sitting here in front of you guys, we have taken a lot of pride in the fact that we've always done what we said we're going to do, and we try to adhere to that and will adhere to it. And that's why, as I'm sitting here today, you know, I can tell you, we will drill additional wells and find more gas to the extent that we come, you know, we find a workable arrangement with everyone. Without that, we will not be able to. We'll just have to wait. And I want to make certain I make that distinction so I don't mislead you and think we're going to do something regardless, because we will not. So
continue if you have more.
Well, you know, I guess at this point I would just say that there are real challenges in doing business in Alaska, but from Armstrong's perspective, we've had success in working with the government agencies, and we've had that success because we've sat down and we've tried to talk to them and relay what our issues are and what our needs are in order to get something done, and the state has been responsive with respect to us. We try not to get too far in front of ourselves and promise something that we cannot deliver. And I guess it's in that context that I say we can find gas. I don't want to guarantee you exactly the quantity of gas, but we think it could be a significant help to the Cook Inlet. But we're going to stop short of saying I can absolutely find this much gas, because we have more wells to drill, and we will drill more wells in order to define how much gas there is that can be found, and we're going to spend our money to do so if we can get into a workable arrangement. And beyond that, it's been a pleasure to sit in front of you, and if there's any questions that come up today or later or whenever, I'm happy to answer them. I'm happy to have a dialogue about how we do business here versus other states or what we see here, but we would like to continue to do business. We'd like to drill a lot more wells in the Cook Inlet if we have the opportunity.
Mr. Carr, I'm pretty sure we're not finished.
Okay.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Mr. Carr, you know, I think you really hit the nail on the head of what I'm trying to figure out in my own mind. You said that you want to continue to explore, spend money in Alaska, create jobs in Alaska, if you can have the correct working environment. And that those two words, that, you know, the working environment, you know, what can the state do to set the stage to make sure that companies want to invest in Alaska? Can you expand on what you would consider a good working environment?
Absolutely. I think from our perspective, a good working environment is one where one can obtain their permits and have the ability to go out and drill wells in a safe fashion. With respect to the Cook Inlet, I think it's one where we can get our product to market and sell it at a price. It allows us opportunity to make a reasonable rate of return on our investment. And I think it's one in where that we can access supplies, access services in a fashion that is not so exorbitant that it necessitates that we cannot make a reasonable return on our investment. I think with respect to the North Slope, it's much the same. You just want to make certain that you're able to conduct business in a safe and efficient manner, but get a reasonable rate of return. I think that's a whole other discussion, because the commodity prices and where they're at on the North Slope today makes it a real challenge to do anything new. But that commodity situation may be changing.
Representative Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, so could you highlight, Mr. Kerr, what you feel are some of the, you know, we're policymakers here, and what are some of the good working environment? What's the highlights of our working environment, and what are some of the low parts of our working environment? What parts do we need to continue to work on to improve relationships so that you want to keep investing in Alaska?
Absolutely. I think the good parts are the people that you have in place at the DNR and at the DOG. Our experience is if you sit down, they'll listen to you, they'll work with you, and if you can honor your side of the equation, they will work hard to try to allow anyone to succeed in drilling wells and trying to find hydrocarbons here in Alaska. I don't know if I can say the other, so I guess I can just throw it out there.
You can say anything you'd like to say, and if it's out of line, I will stop you.
Okay. From the downside, I think we just, and it may not be a downside, it may be anything but, so it's an unfair comment on our part, but when we look at the historical precedent, I just want to make certain in the Cook Inlet that we can obtain a gas contract and get access to a pipeline that allows us to get a reasonable rate of return. And that's not even a negative, because we're not there, and it's an unfair comment for me to make. I'm just, you know, all of this from our standpoint is getting ready to try to get a gas contract, and that's, you know, without that, obviously we're not going to be able to move forward in the Cook Inlet. So that's our primary focus with respect to the Cook Inlet, and then accessing and permitting for pipelines and wells and things like that. But historically, while they've been challenging, we've been able to work through them and get there. By and large, we're a big advocate of Alaska, and sometimes we're in the minority when we're down in other places with respect to that. But, you know, we've been up here for a while and have continued to, and hopefully, with a little luck, we'll be able to stay.
How much do you deal with FERC?
Not very much at all. Not very
much.
That
would be an unfair question to ask if you'd rather deal with FERC or the RCA. I guess that would be.
It would be, an unfair question. I have limited experience with both of them.
Then it shall go and ask. Any other questions that anyone has? Representative Seaton, are you pondering, or are you wrapping up, or I want to give you every opportunity to get the questions asked of your community.
Yes, I guess I would like to ask one other, and that is, would you consider multiple contracts with different communities or different sources? Are you looking for a sole contract that will take your full gas supply, and so that'd be a sole source, sole exit point for you?
Yeah, from our perspective, I can tell you that we can administer in multiple outlets. At the end of the day, for us, it's a pretty simple equation. We just need to make certain that we have that opportunity to get a return on investment. Where the gas goes when it leaves us, you know, there are certain challenges with a split stream, but, you know, could they be administered? I think they could be administered, but for us, the whole issue is if you just never go into a deal you know you can't win at, or you can't achieve your goal. And so that's the main thing. If we had two customers instead of one, that's not the end of the day for us. The issues for us are how much capital do we have to put in? Operationally, how difficult is it for us to do what happens? And there is some operational difficulties, but it might be a question that's better suited for who the transporter is, frankly, than us, because that's going to be an issue that's going to be in their lap more so than ours. And then what we're going to get for our commodity and what we're going to have to pay to get that commodity out of the ground and produce it. Those are really the issues that surround us, and doing so in an environment that, you know, you can continue to do business and the rules aren't changed and everything has that continuity to it.
Representative Seaton, follow up?
And a follow up on that. So when we're talking about a gas sales contract, all right, do you, as an independent or a field operator, would you be making a sale to the shipper? Or is, in the case of like NSTAR, would you be dealing with them as a shipper or as a purchaser, or would they be, be having a sale to Marathon, Conoco at the LNG plant, or would you negotiate that and then have a shipping agreement? How does that kind of work in the Cook Inlet Basin?
You bet. It's a great question. I don't know that there's an absolute answer. I can tell you from our perspective what our preference would be. Our preference would be to sell to a utility and probably looking at selling at the wellhead or selling at Anchor Point or somewhere. And, you know, our whole deal is to try to define, you know, we're going to have some variables and we're going to have some upswing in it because our costs can overrun, but have some certainty of what we're going to be getting for our product and try to control our cost in large degree. And you know, we're going to have to enjoy, you know, one of the issues that I'm sure you've heard before is when commodities go up, costs go up. It's, you know, the service companies are always there. As soon as, you know, the price ticks up, the costs go up. So from our perspective, we need to set some type of a floor with respect to what we can receive for our commodity. And then if the price goes up, you know, we'll take that business risk that any uptick in the commodity price is going to be mitigated, or the uptick in service costs is mitigated because you've gotten some type of an uptick in the commodity price.
Okay. Representative Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kurt, how do you, maybe it's somewhat proprietary, but just a 10,000-foot view of how you coordinate your efforts with your peers in Cook Inlet, you know, Marathon, Conoco, to negotiate FTs with the utility companies, other buyers of your gas, you know, whoever wants to buy. Do you work in a coordinated effort to do that? Because certainly there's a lot of people out there working it, and you can't just be one company that's out there doing that. So can you kind of talk about how that collective business arrangement works?
Absolutely. Great question. You know, again, Cook Inlet is such a unique business environment. It's really a business case study because it's a captured market, if you will, in the amount of production, and it's not tied to other lines. To date, you know, we're a relatively new player in the Cook Inlet with respect to drilling wells and having gas to produce. But with respect to ConocoPhillips, Marathon, et cetera, we really don't have any coordination of saying let's jointly pursue getting a gas contract. It's really just been us on our own, and that's, you know, we have not asked ConocoPhillips and we have not asked Marathon, can we piggyback you for a gas contract? And that's just because intuitively, it's our belief that they would probably want to do their own arrangement exclusive of us. And so we have not, it's not as if we've asked them and they've said, no, you know, we're not going to do something with you. But intuitively, it's our belief that they're probably going to want to work their arrangement on their own and leave us to work our arrangement on their own.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I find that it's something interesting because competition's a good thing. It's a good thing for us consumers. If, you know, you're working in, I guess, independently to contract an FT with MLMP or Chugach Electric, you know, those large industrial users that you are, so you just told us that you're basically on your own on that. There's competition between those industries.
That's correct. Yes, we have not partnered with anyone or sat down and said, why don't you guys go along with us? We're completely independent. And I guess I should qualify. We have a couple of partners. We have three partners within the North Fork unit, and these are other independent oil and gas companies that we've done business with in the past. And so I say that as the group that owns the North Fork unit. We're pursuing it independently.
Any other questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to drill on that. Just I want to make sure I'm very clear in my mind. So you just go to your purchasers of your gas to come up with a contract?
That's correct. That is correct. We do it, and Armstrong, as the operator of the North Fork unit, is the point. And so we will go and contact MLP, Chugach, NSTAR, and anyone else and say, you know, what type of a gas contract can we get? We have never contacted ConocoPhillips and said, hey, can we do a gas contract in tandem with you and go to NSTAR and do something? That has never happened, or with any other company.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that, so NSTAR, although they are a purchaser of gas, with the Kenai Ketchmack pipeline, are they also acting independently as a shipper, so they will ship gas to someone that you contract with, but they don't own the gas?
I think they would if we. I mean, I'm a little bit out of my bounds here, but my presumption would be that they would. But I couldn't speak definitively to that.
For the right, sure. I'm sure you could ship anything.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Newman.
Unless we've got some folks from NSTAR, would they be willing to come up and talk to us, or do you want to maybe do that as a collectively as a different?
I think that's unfair to the chairman, as well as the
people. I know
the
that people, you've got a lot of
the people of NSTAR. But I do anticipate having NSTAR in future hearings on this. Cooking with gas is something that I think everyone's kind of gotten the handle on that I care about. Those are our constituents, and I apologize to the members from Fairbanks and Western Alaska who it may not be quite so important to, but we will deal with your issues too when they come up, I promise. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that it's been interesting to listen to this in relation, you know, this presentation in relationship to a bullet line and cheap gas, or the state putting money into a bullet line and having, you know, attempting for cheap utility gas in South Central, and what the effect would be on companies that are actively drilling in Southeast. And so it's always that balancing act, but you know, we really haven't heard that from any other companies coming to us and telling us that the downside of a bullet line would be what Representative Newman talked about as far as the impacting the jobs in Cook Inlet and also on the ability to produce, and or whether you have to reserve it for a later date.
Right.
So appreciate that.
Yeah, Representative Seaton, I think the thing that I take away from this is we could have gas in 2 years from this. The other thing I'd like to encourage people to quit saying is cheap gas.
Yeah.
I think the day of cheap gas, even though it's at $4 for Cook Inlet, I think we just saw what it costs to lift it. Bullet Line will probably be more than that. I just want us to start concentrating on how expensive it's going to be if we don't have it. And I think that's an area where we can bring some of our members from the north and western Alaska into play. As sympathetic as I am, I don't want to go there. So I think it's more expensive not to have it than it is. So cheap gas may not ever be available to us again, but I certainly want to have gas. Anything else, any other business to come before the committee? With that, as we always adjourn on time, it's 2:25. I want to thank everyone for their attendance. And Mr. Kerr will be around, I'm sure, for a little bit longer if anyone has any questions. We stand in adjournment.